Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 4:09 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is September 29th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. It's also the last day of the third quarter, so it's probably a good time to start thinking about what we can expect from the rest of the year. And I think there's quite a few things to talk about in this broadcast. But the thing that I want to kind of focus on is money supply. So if we think about just a simple way of looking at the markets, that it's easier to make money when there's a lot of money floating around, and it's harder when there isn't. And then on top of that, when money is abundant, then there's usually a good theme that's inspiring investors to participate. And when that theme has plenty of money behind it, then prices accelerate higher and do fantastically well. So then let's just think about it, that we've had successive rounds of additional new money being supplied into the global market at successive rounds, I guess, are plenty of occasions over the last 20, 30 years. And now the big question is, where's the next big capital infusion going to come from that's going to help to support asset prices? Or perhaps another way of thinking about it is, will there be another big supply of cash? Because I think that is perhaps the biggest question. When we look at the inflationary pressures that have been unleashed over the last few years, have central bankers become sufficiently chastened? Have they decided that they are going to mend their ways and that they're not going to pour capital into the global market, risk sparking another round of inflationary pressures on the next occasion that there is an economic downturn? Or has nothing changed? Will they simply continue the way they have been? And I think that is by far the most important question that we have out there in the markets today. Then let's just also spend some time and think about the animating themes that we've had in the market over the course of the last 15 years. Because in the aftermath of the credit crisis, we had a massive devaluation of fiat currencies. There was a huge and sustained increase in the supply of money. At the same time, we had the rise of the global middle class, and we had the rise of the shale revolution in oil production. So, on the one hand, we had lots of new demand coming from literally hundreds of millions, if not billions, of new consumers around the world. And at a time when energy prices were suppressed. And then that was all enabled and I think it, supplemented by the 4G revolution, which basically took the internet out of the office, out of the home, and provided it everywhere. So when that happened, we had these enormous companies evolve that have been the driver of performance in the stock market for the last decade at least, and that still dominate the performance of the stock market, and that they were the ones that benefited most from the evolution of 4G, as well as being those that were most well positioned to benefit from abundant free money for a prolonged period of time. Well, the reason that I have the yen up at the beginning of this broadcast is because I think it is going to be an interesting case study over the course of the next several years. So, with that, let's just embark upon looking at some of these long-term charts. Because the yen is coming back up to test the one, well, I guess it's the dollar is coming back up to test to the 150 area versus the yen. And this is obviously a key level. There have been three occasions when the dollar got up to test 150 in the course of the last 30 years, and on each of those occasions it failed. And in fact, every time it failed at 150, it subsequently went back down and made a new dollar low in the space of a few years or a decade later. So, When we look at the 150 level, then we're at a very important juncture here. When it got up there in at the early 1990s, we had a new dollar low by the time we got to 1995. By the time it got back up there in 1998, we had a new dollar low in 2011. Now it got up there in at September of last year and did not make a new low, and now we're back at this level once more. So now the big question is, has something changed? Because we've seen a similar kind of situation with Japan before. There was a very clear trend similar to that kind of activity with the topics. When we look at the topics index over the lengthy medium term, then what we have is a clear pattern of behavior where, and I do apologize, I'm not typing particularly effectively. So the topics index got up to test the upper side of its range and then made a new low. So every time it, and let me put this into local currency terms, every time it got up to test the 1700 level, it made a new low. And it kept doing that for year after year. Every single example, for all the way from the 1990s through to the middle part of the 2000s. The last time it did it was in 2007, and then it went on to make a new low. It got up to test the 1700 point level again in 2015 and did not make a new low. Subsequently, it made a higher reaction low, broke out, put in a first step above the base, and now we've had this really impressive rebound over the course, really, of the last 6 months. There's a clear trend of outperformance that's been evident since 2010, but it was really that major test of the 1700 area and then subsequently not making a new low that was, I think, the clearest evidence that the topics was now back in a bull trend overall. Now it's overbought in the short term. There is no question of that. And would it be better bought following a process of consolidation? Absolutely. Now the next question then is, are we going to see a tolerance within Japan for a substantially weaker currency? Because it's very oversold. And I think on a fair value basis, I think it is reasonable to argue that the yen is undervalued right now. But at the same time, Japan now has inflation, and they haven't been able to get inflation going for an awfully long time. When we think about where is the liquidity coming to support asset prices at present, well, I think we've really only got two major contenders right now. One is that Japan is continuing to engage in quantitative easing, continuing to inflate the size of their balance sheet, actively engaged in attempting to devalue their currency. And that is a lot of new money that's being printed and pushed out into the global market. And the other major source of new money is the extraordinarily large deficits that the US government are running, that spending way beyond their means for years at a time and no plan for how to curtail that spending. That is something that is helping to support asset prices, particularly in the USA, but globally as well. Those are two major sources of accommodation that are helping to support asset prices, despite the fact that we have interest rates that have been rising globally for the last 18 months, inverted yield curves in several countries, money supply that is contracting in several countries, the total assets of central banks that is trending downwards. So we have certainly seen fewer avenues through which new liquidity are flowing into the global market. But at the same time, there are still some, and Japan is certainly a big one of those. Now, let's then think about the JGB. When we think about the 10-year, There was news today that the Bank of Japan made an unscheduled intervention to buy about $2 billion worth of bonds. And that didn't move the yield at all. In fact, the yield continued higher. Now, it didn't move in a dynamic manner, but it certainly looks like the days of negative yields are over. And that period of time between 2016 and 2022 was one of the most liquidity infused periods of time ever. There was 17.5 trillion of debt that was trading with a negative yield. And today, that number has pretty much disappeared. So we've had an incredible downtrend in government bonds over the course of the last 2 years. It isn't simply that the sector has underperformed. It was one of the worst years ever for bonds in 2022, and 2023 isn't much better. And I think it is something that most people don't really pay attention to. But the reality is that the bond market is it dwarfs the size of the equity market. There is just a profound amount of cash that is tied up in government bonds, and every portfolio must have lost money. But most particularly, it's not simply Japan, it's also Europe. And Germany had a really incredible period of time where they were literally being paid by the market to borrow money. That began in 2016 as well. Then yields popped up a little, but then from about 2019 onwards, yields were sharply negative. Well, yields now are marching higher, and there's been a clear break of the downtrend. So we have had a really incredible advance. Now, I've been of the view that this chart pattern for the Bund future has type 2 bottoming characteristics. Generally speaking, when we see a type 2 bottom, what you have is a loss of downward momentum, and you still have the succession of lower rally highs, but the downward breaks are failing. And we've had several downward breaks fail, or they're dipping back up into the overhead range. Now we've had another break lower in here this week, and the price is starting to rally in here today. Now, I'm of the view that we've had this incredible decline in bond prices, and it's on the assumption that inflationary pressures are here to stay and will remain here for the lengthy medium term. That, and of course, then the consensus now, because we've heard nothing to the contrary from central banks, is that interest rates are going to remain higher for longer. But that is an amorphous term. It really doesn't mean anything. What they're really saying is they're going to leave interest rates high for as long as they don't have a clear excuse to cut them. And as soon as an excuse appears, then they will cut them. And I think that is what we're potentially being set up for now. We've had asset prices that have held up really rather well, and particularly on Wall Street, where the eight largest companies, or what are now more, I think, correctly termed the Magnificent Seven, have been the clearest outperformers over the course of the last decade. And they are beginning to stumble a little, but there's no clear evidence of a rollover just yet. But we are definitely seeing liquidity conditions tightening. Now, when we think about what's going on in Japan, well, they are clearly devaluing their currency. They are looking at bond yields that are now trending higher. And that has helped to support the nominal price of the stock market because the stock market is simply appreciating in nominal terms to reflect the inflation rate and the supply of cash. And of course, if it's happening like that in Japan, then we should be thinking in the same terms for the nominal price appreciation reflecting the inflation rate in other markets as well, which also helps to emphasize the relative performance compared to inflation or the real performance of stocks when you have inflationary pressures that are quite high. I'm posting an article from USA Today in Comment of the Day, but and I really only wanted to highlight just one important point. When you look at what the average wage is, and I guess more correctly, it's the median wage, that people got a 14% pay rise in the last 12 months, and in order to move jobs, they demand an additional 13% pay rise. So when we hear that the Federal Reserve wants to keep interest rates high and they're in no mood for cutting them, well, that's the reason why. Because we have the very real prospect, not only in the USA, but also in other countries, particularly where mortgage rates have become problematic because of floating rates. So in countries like the UK, Australia, or Canada, where there's the potential for a wage price spiral. And obviously, central banks are then in a difficult position. They're not able to cut rates aggressively when wage growth is jumping like that. But I think that we are now coming up to the point where the lagged effect of all that interest rate tightening is beginning to have an effect. And it's worth also considering that if the two big drivers of asset price appreciation over the last year have been Japan and the US government deficit, if they don't come to a budget agreement in the twilight hours of the weekend, this weekend, then the government is going to start shutting down in the USA on Monday. And that's going to curtail spending for as long as it takes agreement to be made. And then, of course, there is going to be the haggling about what spending will be. And we are only a year out from the next presidential election. So I suspect that what we're really seeing now is jockeying for position. And it's likely to be an exceptionally negative campaign. And there is really a lot to play for. Because the reality is that whoever comes into power is going to have to deal with the very real potential for fiscal consolidation. And that's not something anybody wants to deal with. So in fact, there might be an incentive to lose the election so that you can then ensure that you'll win the next several elections by blaming whatever administration wins for the trouble that they're going to have to enact on the American people. And again, that is a recipe for a seriously negative campaign. So I think that we are at an interesting juncture here because stock markets are still right in the region of their peaks. So let's think then about some of the measures of stock market health that I think are important to pay attention to. So the advanced decline line for the S&P 500 really hasn't gone anywhere for the last year and a half. It peaked right at the beginning of 2022, and then we've had a bit of back and forth action, certainly, and there's been an upward bias over the last 12 months. But now it's back below the 200-day moving average. Now, it's not the first time it's done that. There have been several occasions over the last year and a half where it has dipped below the 200-day moving average. But there has definitely been no other example of a lengthy range like this over the last 20 years. The closest thing we have is from back in 2015. And then we saw a really exceptional move higher in 2016. Now, when the advanced decline line is advancing like that, it means that the vast majority of companies are seeing rising prices relative to falling prices on a day-over-day basis or on a week-over-week basis. When we have a range like this, it means that the number of advancing shares relative to the declining shares is pretty even. And that is a recipe for a very mixed market environment, which is exactly what we've had. Now, that's obviously just for the S&P 500. If we look at it on the total number of shares for the NYSE, we've had a good sized pullback in 2022. So the vast majority of shares went down in 2022, and now this week it is also closing in the region of that 200-day moving average. And there is obviously the potential here that we're looking at a deeper process of consolidation. Now, if we go back and look at what peaks look like, in 2007 it peaked. And then it trended downwards and encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average on successive occasions, all the way through until early 2009, and then subsequently it went straight up. And by the time we got into the early part of 2010, it was at a new all-time high. Now that's what a really significant recovery in the total market looks like after a big decline. Then we can think about what happened in 1998 when it peaked. So that was 2 years before the total market peaked. And then it was trending downwards all the way through until the end of 2001. We had a high reaction low in 2002, and then it took off in 2003. And by the time we got out to 2006, it was at a new all-time high. And that was another important peak. We can also be very conscious of the fact that in this lengthy period, we were in a secular bear market for Wall Street, all the way from 1998 through until about 2011, 12. The market was basically going sideways, and so was the advanced decline line. We were in, and we are at least for now, at least we are still in a more secular trend environment for Wall Street. And the big question now is whether that is over or whether it is going to be sustained, and how well the region of the 1,000-day moving average holds is going to be a very important signal. But simply going down from the 200-day moving average to the 1,000-day moving average would represent a significant decline on Wall Street. And so I think that is something that we should be paying attention to. Then I think we should just round it out and look at the performance of the NASDAQ. And what I think is most particularly interesting is this advanced decline line had a profound decline after the peak in the late 1990s. And it didn't really bottom out until 2012. And it had a meaningful breakout in 2021 with the evolution of the work from home trend and the incredible amount of money printed to support the global economy. And since then, it has done nothing but decline. And that is despite the fact that when we look at the NASDAQ composite, it has gone up and done a really incredibly well in terms of the rebound we've had over the course of the last year. Now, I think it's important to highlight here that the initial drawdown in 2000 was 40%, and the initial drawdown in 2022 was about 34%. And on both occasions, there was a meaningful jump higher. And in fact, since this didn't in actually bottom in that period. I usually look at this as so the initial drawdown was 38%, and the initial rebound so far at least was 43%. But we also had a big rebound in 2000, and the market went up in a really impressive fashion by about 40% in the middle of 2000, and then subsequently pulled back in a very violent manner. So the big bet on this occasion that is that things really are different, and the sales for Nvidia aren't just high now, but that they are going to remain high and continue to improve forever. So that is obviously betting that the trend of artificial intelligence, the quantity of money that's going to be devoted to building out the data center market, is going to be profound. Now, Microsoft this week is starting to talk about building its own nuclear reactors to provide the power necessary to run its data centers. So we're talking about an energy demand curve that is really quite incredible. But that's unlikely to be beneficial for oil. And when you're talking about running a data center, well, then you can't run it on intermittent power. So you need base load. There have been instances over the course of the last decade where data centers were hooked up directly to natural gas pipelines, and that they would simply burn the natural gas as they required it. And that was the power that helped to drive the electricity production for their data centers. So building nuclear reactors and hooking them up directly, it might sound like an extreme thing, but it has actually happened, or close to something that has happened in the past. And of course, we have Microsoft and Bill Gates have been some of the biggest investors in fusion energy, and Haleon is one of those companies. And well, at least they are talking about the fact that they have a working prototype for fusion. So think is one of the sort of the interesting potential game changers in terms of energy. So let's think about what we can and I guess the graphic that they have on Helion's, or Helion, I guess would be the best way to pronounce it. Their graphic is really quite interesting. It shows how they're building their fusion plant. And of course, that is on the assumption that it works. But there's certainly a lot of money going into it. And this is potentially an example of how Craig Venter was able to circumvent the slow bureaucratic production of our effort to sequence the human genome. And he was able to do it cheaper and faster. And now we have a similar kind of condition where nuclear energy research coming through for the ITER project in the south of France to produce the first fusion energy sometime in the early 2030s has basically been acquired by the private sector, and through the use of what are often referred to as room temperature superconductors, which are basically superconductors that do not need to be super cooled. Room temperature is might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but they don't need to be super cooled to close to absolute zero to function. And those are now being used for the containment fields for fusion reactions. And I think the big story from Google over the last several years is that they were using artificial intelligence to try and predict the path of plasma in a magnetic containment field in order to contain the tokamak type of reaction. And they did have some experience with that, or I guess some moderate success with that. But we also know that the fusion has been achieved by using a completely different method, which is bombarding a small fuel cell with lasers from every possible angle and creating the compression necessary to get fusion running. But it's very difficult to repeat and then to create a sustaining reaction, or to create sufficiently large numbers of repeated reactions that the energy can be captured in a useful fashion. So it's not like there isn't some kind of progress being made, but the timelines tend to be kind of exaggerated by the media. And obviously, Helion, they're talking about having a working prototype by 2026. That's only 2 years from now. So obviously, that is something that could really spark a profound bull market, because it's really all about the return on energy deployed. And right now, we have energy prices that are rallying. But this is a very different type of situation. It's not like other big bull markets we've had in the energy prices. When we think about the big bull market that began in the early 2000s and ran all the way through until 2008, had a big big pullback and then rebounded exceptionally quickly. Well, it was really about the fear of peak oil. So there had to be a big investment, a massive investment internationally to build energy infrastructure, to go and explore, to build offshore pipe drilling platforms, to find new oil. And it was incredibly successful. We've had the shale revolution, which has turned the USA into the biggest oil producer in the world, one of the biggest exporters, and reversed decades where it was the biggest consumer and importer. That's one of the most profound changes ever. Then the pre-salt was discovered off the coast of Brazil. And today, there's increasing talk about how the big discovery off the coast of Namibia is going to be deployed. So we're not in the same kind of situation. Nobody is talking about peak oil supply today. What people are talking about instead is peak demand. And that whole question around peak demand is the primary reason why prices are rising, because it's inhibiting the investment required to continue to produce oil. If oil companies have to go to the market and borrow billions and invest in long-term pieces of architecture that are built at a cost of tens of billions and then are expected to produce cash flow for several decades, they're not going to get that money if the bankers and institutional funds are worried that nobody's going to be using that infrastructure in 5 years, not a mind in 25 years. So we're not seeing the same volume of new money being deployed into the energy sector as we've had in the past. And all of the majors have pulled back. And then we have the situation in OPEC where they're curtailing supply. Well, if they're not producing as much, it also means they're not spending as much on increasing supply. So the capital that's being deployed into the energy sector is deteriorating, and demand has not had a big decline. We're still seeing significant demand growth for oil coming out of the emerging markets. And of course, this is the other thing that OPEC are looking at. They're looking at what's been happening with oil demand in those developed markets. Don't even think at the moment about electric vehicles, which are inconsequential so far, really, in terms of demand growth for energy. And just think about the fact that as countries have got richer and as populations have seen their living standards rise, well, then the one of the first things that they demand is clean water. Then they start to demanding clean air. And now we're in the situation where people are starting to demand cleaner food. And certainly the diets of the population tend to morph and change as well. But certainly we've seen in Europe and in North America, demand for oil has gone down as the vehicle stock has become more efficient. And as the move to working online and less commuting, then we've had a significant change in demand profiles. And OPEC will be looking at that development, looking at continued demand growth from the emerging markets, in the full knowledge that as those markets improve, as living standards increase, then demand for oil will probably peak eventually, and demand for gas will peak later. And the usage of gas goes up as living standards improve because people start demanding cleaner air. Now, we're nowhere near that particular tipping point yet in China or India. In fact, China is building more coal-fired power stations now than it has in years. And at the same time, they're banking on being able to export solar panels, batteries, and wind turbines to the rest of the world, while simultaneously powering their entire economy with coal. And of course, that is the action of an energy importer. Now, are they building at nuclear reactors? Absolutely. And is the sentiment towards the uranium sector improving? It definitely is. The GlobalX uranium ETF has been surging over the last several weeks. It's coming back up now into the region of the peaks from early 2022, but it hasn't really completed a first step above the base just yet. And we are coming off really quite depressed levels. And even here, we have a short-term overbought condition, so we might even get some consolidation here in the region of the peak from back in 2022. When we think about that clear contradiction where China is building coal-fired power stations for its own use and expecting everyone else to buy its exports of renewable energy infrastructure, I don't know how long that contradiction is going to be tolerated by the rest of the world. But so far, at least, it is being tolerated. The reality is that if we want to decarbonize, the only way to do that is with nuclear. And nuclear is certainly more efficient. It is definitely one of the clear potential beneficiaries of technological innovation. And when we think about how we're going to have another big bull market, well, we need to solve for energy, we need to solve for productivity, and we need to solve for a new bull theme that will really help to inspire people. But most of all, we need additional liquidity. And that, I think, is going to be the big question. So when we think about this, the total assets of central banks, this has been a very useful way of thinking about markets. Because all the way through until the peak in 2022, there was a sharp and very clear correlation between the performance of the stock market and the rise in central bank balance sheets. But now those central bank balance sheets are coming down, and it's down to 27.6 trillion, and that hasn't been updated through the end of September yet. So we're still in an environment where it's unwinding the short term, or well, like I'm not even going to call it short term because it's been reverting to the mean for the last year and a half, but it's right in the region now of the 5-year moving average. So we're at a critical juncture. It has never sustained a move below the 5-year moving average. And I think that this is one of the most important points, that when you have very low interest rates for a prolonged period of time, it stretches duration. So you can tolerate exceptional duration on your investments because money is free and the interest rate competition is not nearly as pressing. But when interest rates rise, well, then what it means is effectively that the duration on investments compresses. And that is pushing up yields at the long end of the curve. And the 10-year yield is up to 4.57%, and it's continuing to push higher. Now, we are very oversold, and this is going to persist moving higher until we eventually see the Federal Reserve declaring victory over inflation. But in terms of that shortening of duration, the duration of investments is creating demand for the 3-month, and 3-month yields are not rallying nearly as quickly. So what we're actually now starting to see is something we have not seen since 1980, which is that the yield curve spread is de-inverting, but it's doing so by the 10-year yield rising faster than the 3-month. Now, that has only happened in 1980. On each of the other occasions when we've had an inverted yield curve, whether that is in 1989, the early 2000s, or 2006, or in 2019, it was the 10-year yield was going down before the 3-month. It priced in interest rate cuts. And it didn't do that in 1980. And that was also one of the times when there was a real inflationary problem. And what really needed to happen was a deep recession in order to bring down those inflationary pressures and to correct at the liquidity situation. And then subsequently, we were embarked upon an historically large bull market. So I think it is also worth considering that there was a double dip in terms of the yield curve spread in the early 1980s. It was deeply inverted. It became uninverted and went right up to 350 basis points to the positive, and then came straight back down again. Now, that happened, of course, because interest rates at the time were exceptionally high, and big moves were occurring at both the long end and the short end. So we had a lot of chop in the relationship. But what we can certainly say right now is that the yield curve spread is trending higher. It has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. This is the biggest jump we've had in that spread since it originally became inverted. And it's usually the time when the Federal Reserve first cuts interest rates. That is generally when you get the biggest selling pressure in stock markets. I don't believe that we're going to go back into the same kind of situation that we had after 2008. I believe that central bankers are sufficiently chastened. They are not going to leave the accommodation in the system for as long on the next occasion. They are going to be more disciplined. And they don't have a lot of choice. Central bankers now have to be more disciplined because politicians are not. We've seen deficit spending on an extraordinary scale on several occasions over the last 3 years. And that has been enabled by central bankers. It's been facilitated by central bankers. And the reality is that has been one of the causal effects in the big jump in inflation that we've had, the very real prospect of a wage price spiral as a result. So if politicians aren't going to get their act together and begin to curtail fiscal expense, well, then that is something that is going to have to be dealt with by central bankers. They're not going to be able to cut interest rates as much, but they will cut interest rates. They're not going to be able to print as much money as they have in the past, but they will still print the money. And they're not going to be able to leave that money in the system for as long as they have in the past. But it will be there for as long as is strictly required. And we've seen examples of that already. The Bank of England did it with their pension crisis. The Federal Reserve did the same thing with the demise of several of the regional banks in March of this year. And I think it's worth considering that there are several of those regional banks are still under duress. And this is not a trending environment. We had quite a clear pattern of recovery for regional banks between the low in early 2009 and the original peak in 2018. We had a fairly steep pullback in 2018, just like the rest of the market, but it didn't recover. We had a very deep pullback in 2020. Everything recovered at the same time, and subsequently now we're seeing these banks leading on the downside. Then I am deeply suspicious of the housing sector. And the reason that I say that is I don't have any history as a good real estate investor. But all I know is that the home I currently live in has doubled in value in less than 2 years. And that's an extraordinary appreciation. When we think about the difference between the cash in people's pockets and their feelings of wealth, then that I think is a great example of that. Regardless of how your job is going, if the value of your home has doubled, you automatically feel wealthier because you know that if anything bad happens, well, you can always take the cash out of your home. You could sell the home, you can take a cash out refi, anything that you want to do, you can base it upon the asset in your hand. So it creates a wealth effect. But an increase of 100% in the value of a property in the space of 2 years is ridiculously large. And it does not, obviously, we haven't had the same kind of building boom on this occasion as we had in 2006. But home affordability in the USA today is at the worst it has ever been. And home sales figures are continuing to go down. Now, we have not seen a big increase in the supply of houses. There aren't a lot of people leaving them because interest rates are still high. So, when people start to see, though, that interest rates are starting to come back down, well, then I think that's going to be a catalyst for more people to want to sell and to capture the cash that's available in their homes so that then they can supplement their pensions. And there could be a really significant increase just by simply people deciding that they can now sell and that they could go and buy because they'll be able to refinance at lower rates later. And I think that is something that could be potentially quite deleterious to the property market if everybody decides that they want to cash out at the same time. And the home builders got all the way back up to test the peak in 2021 and has now come back down to test the region of the 200-day moving average. So we've had a lot of different US indices that have done that. The one thing that I'm very cautious about is the performance of various asset classes relative to the NASDAQ. When we look at commodities, for example, they have collapsed relative to the NASDAQ. But then let's just look at commodities. So just the raw CRB index, it's recovering. And we've had a big move off the lows in 2020, and prices today are pretty much where they were in 2008. But it's not an in a downtrend. What we really see from that kind of ratio is not so much that commodities are undervalued, but rather that the NASDAQ is remarkably overvalued. And then when we look at the ex-US market relative to the US market, well, we get exactly the same thing. But of course, the performance of the US market has been dominated by those very large companies. And the ex-US portion of the global economy couldn't possibly keep up with that. So the relative trend is downwards. And then, of course, we have value versus growth, and it basically shows the same thing. And we've had bump higher in 2022, and it has subsequently come all the way back down. So really what we're seeing at all these ratios, they just tell us one thing. They tell us that these eight companies beat everything. And as long as that remains the case, there isn't going to be the push factor. There isn't going to be a big swell of cash leaves these companies because they're still performing. And they're performing in line with the market right now, but it's still holding at above the previous peaks. So those eight companies represent 23.7% of the entire market, and they have outperformed for the last decade. And how much profit erosion have people experienced? There's certainly been a pullback on occasion for Tesla or Microsoft or Meta or Nvidia, but then they've subsequently rebounded and put on a significant uptrend, and every time they've pulled back, they've recovered. And this, to me, it seems quite similar to the kind of mentality that existed before 2008 with the miners. I remember BHP Billiton that it did not have a consistent trend, and it was prone to pulling back violently. And provided you held on, you were rewarded with higher prices. Now we can think about Meta. So Meta really did quite well, all the way up from the original IPO price. As soon as it IPO'd, it dropped. So it IPO'd around 45 and it got down to 14. And then we had a significant downtrend in 2018, and it went from 218 down to 121. So we're talking about its potential to fall by almost 50% and still be in a bull market. Then in 2022, it came down from under 400 to 100 and subsequently rebounded to 300. So we're talking about a trend of performance that has been incredible, but it hasn't been a consistent trend throughout. There have been occasions when it has been consistent, particularly between 2012 and 2018, and the big move up from 2020 to 2022. I think it would be an awful stretch to say that this trend is still consistent. We had a crash type scenario realistically in 2022 and a massive rebound. Now, I've seen a video, or I guess it's a video podcast that Mark Zuckerberg has given, where he's deploying the new virtual reality headsets, and you have to be scanned at one of their facilities to really get the best illustration of your facial features. And it does look very close to reality that two heads in a black background are chatting to one another, and you can see the other person's facial expressions. And the capabilities of virtual reality and mixed reality are really impressive. But I guess I've got 46-year-old eyes, and whenever I play with the virtual reality headset that we got in 2020, I get eye strain. I can't use it 2 days in a row, and I can't use it for more than half an hour at a time. So I can fully understand the excitement around the capabilities of the technology. I just don't see how people will be able to use it for long periods of time until they actually solve that particular problem. And if it requires training of the eyes and building up the muscles in your eyeballs, well, I think that's probably a young person's game. And I just don't see how it is something that I, for example, could do the chart seminar. And everybody attending the chart seminar for 2 full days would be wearing a headset. I think by the end of it, we'd all be bleary-eyed. And perhaps some veteran subscribers might think they're bleary-eyed already. Well, when we look at some of these shares, Meta, for example, has rebounded in a straight line. It's no longer going up in a straight line. And if we start to see the economy rolling over, this is still a company that relies on advertising. Google has got lots of additional business lines that it has been investing in for several years. And the big one, of course, is Waymo and autonomous driving. And then, of course, they have their DeepMind and their own artificial intelligence, and I think more correctly, deep learning. And that deep learning and the projects, for example, that they have, like AlphaFold, these are big science projects that have real world and long-term potential for growth. It's not like we're not getting anything out of this big bull market we've had over the last 15 years. We have reusable rockets, and we have a lot of money that's been poured into new energy potential. And some of those science projects will create new bull market conditions. But I think we need to go through a bear market first. I think that we have not solved for inflation, and we haven't solved for the new supply of liquidity. And I think that the kinds of investments that are going to be fruitful over the next decade are going to be longer duration. They're what we're going to, or I guess that's not what I meant to say. I apologize. They're not going to be longer duration. They're not going to be these blue sky promise type investments. And that I think is probably why the ARK Innovation ETF isn't doing as well. So these were the long duration type investments. What I think we are going to have is more of a focus on in energy baseload, not intermittent supply. In the healthcare sector, it's going to be on the kinds of companies that can generate real productivity gains for the global economy, those that can really appeal to the mass market. We've had a real focus over the last decade on rare diseases. Rare diseases are the kinds of, I guess, for the biotech sector, if you are focusing on a rare disease, it means that what you're able to do is speed up the trial process because there is no existing treatment. So that allows you to get to market quickly and you get to experiment with new technologies faster. But the downside of that is because it's a rare disease, you're not going to have as many potential people using it. So it tends to be very narrow in breadth. What we are starting to see now, and where the real success stories are coming through, is in the treatment of obesity. Now, that is a mass market business model where innovation in the sector can have a profound effect on both balance sheets for companies as well as the global population. Diabetes is one of the biggest productivity inhibitors we have in the world today, and combating it is something that can be particularly beneficial and will be the kind of thing that will enhance global productivity. Now, then on the other side of that, we have the problem with malaria and with the prevalence of malaria carrying and dengue fever carrying and West Nile, for that matter, mosquitoes moving into places like Florida, Texas, France, Italy. And obviously, this is something that is going to require a more aggressive treatment regime. So there will be additional money will certainly flow into treating malaria and these other tropical diseases. And I think that there will be genetic solutions that will be aimed exclusively at attempting to curtail the spread of the mosquitoes. And of course, that will then also roll through into Africa, and it will enhance productivity growth in that region as well. Now, when we think about where the best currency performance is right now, the dollar has had a really clear pattern of outperformance over the last 3 months. It's been up in consecutive weeks, and that definitely started to take a lump out of the gold price in here this week. The dollar, though, is only going up right now because of the interest rate differential. And the positive real rate that the dollar is enjoying is certainly helping to support the argument for owning dollars, and it is certainly also inhibiting the demand for gold. Now, we can definitely look at the times when gold has done best. So, we had a big decline in gold in 2008, but as soon as the trend of real rates turned, well, that's when we had the big recovery. When real rates started to turn around again in 2012 and marched higher, well, gold did not do well. And gold did very well in at the end of 2018 through to 2020. So, what I find most particularly interesting right now is that over the last few years, even though real rates have been trending higher, gold prices have basically gone sideways. And I think this is going to be one of the big trends when interest rates eventually do start to come back down. Now, gold prices are certainly ebbing right now and broke below the $1,900 area this week and could easily come back down into the region of the lower side of the range. And that is likely to provide a buying opportunity. When interest rates start to come back down in the USA, then that is going to take some of the wind out of the demand for the dollar. It's also likely to represent a recession risk. And the customers that have helped to support the incredible earnings power of the mega caps is also going to ebb. And that is going to further push money out of the USA. And gold and emerging markets tend to appreciate for many of the same reasons. And I think that the demise of the dollar will be profoundly bullish for gold. And I think the dollar is overdue a lengthy process of consolidation. Now, it really does depend on what happens with central banks. If I'm wrong, and I think there is obviously a 50-50 chance here that the Federal Reserve does not mend its ways and they do go off and print a ton of money again, well, then gold is going to double in value. If, on the other hand, we see a greater willingness to have some fiscal consolidation in the USA, well, then the big question will be how much of a global trend is that? And if the USA goes it alone, well, then that will be positive for the dollar overall, and it might inhibit some of the performance of gold in US dollars. But I just think that that is it is an unlikely scenario, but it's a possible scenario that we're not going to have the same amount of money printed. I think what is likely, though, is we will have money printed. It just won't stay in the market for as long. And that means that gold will go up and then pause and go up again later and pause. And we've had plenty of examples of that. The thing about gold is that it tends to put in the majority of its advances in a very short period of time and then subsequently ranges for a long time. And I suspect that will be the same situation on the next big breakout. But in the short term, we have to be prepared for gold to come back down and potentially trade below $1,800. And that is certainly what the downward dynamic we've seen this week begins to suggest. I put up a correlation chart for Bitcoin over the last year in Comment of the Day yesterday. And Bitcoin prices are still hovering here around the 27,000 level. Now, when the halving occurs in April of next year, the cost of production is going to double. And at present, it's around 15,000, and it's going to double to 30,000. And that's simply break even. And usually miners require a margin because mining is an inherently uncertain profession. After the halving, you generally get a limited supply argument. But what we've definitely seen is, as part of the 4-year cycle, you generally tend to get a big surge in new money supply not long after a halving. Now, this isn't related to the halving. I think it is more related to the 4-year presidential cycle that you have in the USA. Now, I think the presidential cycle in the US has changed over the last decade, and most particularly following the successful election of Donald Trump, because what he did in his first year was to enact a massive fiscal stimulus. And that disrupted the normal course of events for the presidential election cycle. Usually, what happens is they clean house and you get less fiscal support in the first year of the presidential cycle, and you get more money printed in the third year. And of course, for his third year, then you had the beginning of the Well, you had a big pullback in 2018. You had the Federal Reserve raising rates. It looked like there was going to be a recession. Then you had the pandemic in his fourth year. So then that upset the cycle as well. But what we have seen with Bitcoin is a clear cyclicality, that every time there has been a halving, it has coincided with another new surge of fresh liquidity into the market. And we're in an interesting environment right now because we have tightening global liquidity. I think that is a present factor. And when we do have a recession, we'll have expanding global liquidity. When we think about global migration, I think this is at least geopolitically fueled in some cases, but then it's also a factor that we have a growing global population, massive disparities in relative living standards between countries, and if people can walk between those countries, they will. And the opening of the Darien Gap in Panama basically opens up the entire Latin American continent to walk to the USA. And we are seeing millions of people doing exactly that. We're also seeing that people are getting boats, getting ships, getting planes into Latin America, getting off the boat and just walking. And that's a clear trend that is occurring in the USA. We're definitely also seeing the Wagner Group from Russia and the anti-Francophile trend of independence movements right across the Sahel that are kicking out the French administrations and becoming more independently minded, helped along in many cases by Russia, but also that represents a massive swell of potential migrants into Europe. This is the kinds of ways that governments have been dealing with refugees is inevitably going to change. When we think about fiscal consolidation, then the whole question of borders and dealing with refugees or how refugees are defined is inevitably going to change because of simply weight of numbers, and that is weight of numbers in terms of people and weight of numbers in terms of expense. Over the course of the next decade, there's going to be a profound change in the makeup of the global consumer. So I thought it was particularly interesting this week that, or I guess really in September, we saw examples of where major luxury brands have been acquiring real estate in Mumbai. And within the same month, an inverted commas expose of manufacturing capacity for luxury goods in India. And I just can't help but think that is part of a wider effort to attract interest in those goods from an increasingly wealthy middle class in India. That not only are they buying luxury goods that have a made in France or a made in Italy label, but rather that they're supporting their domestic industry. And it feeds into that nationalism. Of course, we've had a very similar condition with many of the luxury goods from Italy because several of those older factories were bought by Chinese entrepreneurs in the aftermath of the credit crisis in 2008. And most of that stuff is manufactured in China and then has made in Italy sewn on, which is the big value point when it is shipped into Italy. And again, that is all part of the global supply chain. But with global, I think, increasing geopolitical tensions and the big question about how the rest of the world is going to deal with an increasingly strident China, we're going to see duplication. There will be investment in longer-term infrastructure projects. On the assumption that they'll throw off cash flow because of geopolitical tensions. This has been the lengthiest period of time that the Mexican peso has been appreciating ever. So this is a really profound change. Now it is being clearly supported by the high interest rate, but consumer demand growth in places like Mexico and Brazil and Colombia is improving. They aggressively raised interest rates, and now they are reaping the benefits of that. The best performing shares in the best performing share in Brazil this year is an education company, and the best performing share in Mexico is a restaurant. but their indices are dominated by commodities and banks. And those are not the shares that are likely to lead in a new bull market environment. This is a really an example of how we're going to see the rise of the global consumer, and countries that are not particularly aligned with either the USA or with China will benefit from that competition. And Latin America is certainly open for business and is going to benefit from that competition, and so is India. Then what's happening right now with the Philippines is also interesting, that you have the new government there has been more stridently in favor of relations with the USA. Now, I think the currency is going to be something to pay attention to. If there were a clear risk of a problem between the Philippines and China, I would anticipate that the currency would start to depreciate, and at present, at least, it's looking like it's finding support. And of course, then when we think about the supply of global liquidity, well, the big disappointment over the last 18 months has been China. And it did look like if the cyclicality of the market was going to persist, then the credit impulse would have turned higher, and it hasn't. And are we looking potentially at a re-socialization and the potential that all of the private sector property developers will be allowed to go bust, their assets will be acquired by the state, and property development will exclusively become part of the state apparatus? That's a realistic possibility. And when we zoom in then and look at the currency, the fact that the renminbi has not yet broken down suggests that they're not yet supporting the economy in a dynamic fashion. But you can't have it both ways. They cannot stimulate the economy in a big way without and also support the currency. To do that, they would have to spend a large portion of their currency reserves, and I just don't believe that they're going to be willing to do that. What they will do, though, is persist with those piecemeal measures. But in terms of global liquidity and the potential for a big new infusion, then China's a potential source, but they're not doing it just yet. So, in the absence of a big new source of global liquidity, we should anticipate that asset prices will be lower until we see that infusion. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend. I'll wish all the best to all of you. And I look forward to another interesting quarter.